This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb and tonight's guest, Professor George L. Maddox of Duke University. Tonight's subject, why do teenagers drink? You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, night people. This is Gibb. Standing by in Durham, North Carolina, at Duke University, is Professor George L. Maddox of the Medical Sociology Department and co-author of Drinking Among Teenagers. If you'd like to ask Dr. Maddox a question about tonight's topic, why do teenagers drink, or make a comment about drinking teenagers, give us a call here at our national night call number. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. You may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open, and we await your call. Area code 313-846-6601. Professor Maddox, is teenage drinking a real problem?
Well, whether the drinking is a problem or not depends on to whom you ask that question. There's no question that the drinking of some teenagers is a problem. But I feel that most drinking by most teenagers is not a problem.
The teenagers that drink, why do they drink?
They drink for very much the same reasons that adults do. It's interesting to ask the young people themselves why they do, and when you do, you get very much the same answers, no matter what part of the country you're talking to the teenager. The typical answer you get is they drink in order to say something about themselves, to say that they are growing up, that they are becoming adult. They're trying to say that they're human beings who understand what it means to be an adult. They drink also to identify themselves with people their own age. These are the reasons primarily, to identify themselves, to say who they are.
What about adults that drink then? Why do they drink? If the teenagers are trying to imitate adults, what reason can we have for adults drinking?
Well, it's interesting to ask the young people themselves why they think adults drink, and they give very much the same answers for the adults as they give for themselves. They see adult drinking largely as a matter of identifying themselves, of saying something about themselves, who they are. A man who drinks like a man who tries to suggest what his social status is by how he drinks. The young person does attribute to the adult one reason for drinking that he does not attribute to himself, and that is to reduce anxiety or attention. He recognizes, the teenager recognizes that the adult drinks for that reason, but teenagers do not ordinarily attribute that reason to themselves.
In one way, you're saying that teenagers drink because they're searching for identification. Are they searching for identification of their sex?
Well, this is partly it. There's no question that not only among teenagers, but among adults, that certain kinds of drinking are associated with masculinity. You can see this in terms of the kinds of drinks. Whiskey, for example, is a man's drink primarily. Mixed drinks has a more feminine connotation, and wine has the most feminine connotation of all.
Well, now that's in the United States, though.
Yes.
In Europe, wine is a very masculine drink, is it not?
That's right. We're talking, I assume, about teenagers in this country.
Right.
There are important variations as you move not only between countries, but in various sections of the United States.
You mean teenagers drink different types of beverages in different areas of the country?
Well, they have preferences.
Well, what are these preferences, Doctor?
Well, beer remains the primary preference of young people, though as we shift into certain areas of the Midwest, one finds that wine may be more preferred, but beer remains the basic preference for young people wherever we find them. And this has to do with both the cost of the beverage, its availability, and the low alcohol content of the beverage. It's easily accessible to the young person. It's the most common beverage used.
What has the greatest effect on a teenager as far as drinking is concerned? His home, his parents, or other kids?
Well, this is widely debated, and I think we'd have to specify what young people we're talking about and what age the young person is.
Does it vary? Is it different?
Oh, yes, it certainly does.
Well, let's take the... Do 12-year-olds drink?
Well, 12, 13, 14 is the year in which we ordinarily observe young people beginning to experiment with what they call drinking.
All right, let's talk about that group first.
All right. Now, before that time, young people may have been exposed to the use of alcohol. They ordinarily talk about this as tasting, as distinct from drinking. Drinking is the term they ordinarily use to specify when they are taking a drink as a person. That is, rather than simply being allowed to taste, they're doing something on their own. This begins to appear between 12 and 14, about the time the young person goes to junior high school, about what we call the introduction of puberty. At this particular time, the young person is most likely to be reflecting his exposure to his parental family.
Now, what do you mean, reflecting his exposure?
Well,
that sounds awful sociological to me.
For example, if the young person has been exposed to a family in which alcohol is used, he is more likely to begin the process of experimentation and to begin it earlier than if he comes from a family in which alcohol is not used.
That's because of the availability.
Well, it's partly the availability, yes, but also in terms of the way in which the parents use alcohol. That is, the way in which they integrate it into their style of life.
If a father is a boozy, will the kid tend to hop on the beer wagon?
Well, now, that's your phrase, not mine. You mean the father drinks.
Right. I mean an alcoholic. That's a slang term for an alcoholic.
Oh, if you mean he's... No, this doesn't necessarily follow at all. It's been found by a number of people who've done research in this area that whether or not there is a parent who has difficulty with alcohol, who's an alcoholic, is not a good predictor of what we'll see in the young person. We sometimes see young people who respond in a very negative way to what they see, a kind of defensive reaction to what they see in the parent.
In other words, if father drinks a lot, they may not even touch it then.
That's right. That's right.
Now, what about females? Do the girls react the same way to a drinking father?
Well, I don't know that the research really permits us to make a distinction about the different response of boys and girls. Here we get in a very complex situation of whether we're talking about a mother or a father who has a problem. I don't know that research allows us to distinguish the fine details of the difference in reaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what about the effects of the other kids on kids drinking?
Now,
we're talking about the 12 to 14-year-old.
That's right. Now, as we move into the 14, 15, 16, there are many indications that one of the preoccupations of the young person is finding his relationship with people outside his family. This has been an important issue before. It becomes an especially important issue in the early years of high school. As the youngster gets older still, as we begin talking about 17 and 18-year-olds, we find him returning to a pattern that looks more like the behavior we saw in his parents. So we have to specify what's the age of the young person. At various times in his development, his peers are more or less important to him.
Are most American teenagers taking a drink today?
Yes, most do. It's a rare young person who gets through an American high school without having experimented at least once with beverage alcohol.
Now, what about a parent? When can he expect the kid to try the first drink on his own without the parent being present? And, not the idea here, try taste the beer routine.
Yeah, 12 to 14, for example, is the time in which most young people will begin this experimentation.
Now, will they do this in a secret way as far as the parents are concerned?
Well, it depends a great deal on the parents themselves. If the parents have drinking as part of their lifestyle, if it's open and above board with the parents, it's quite likely that the parents provide that situation and are quite aware that the young person is beginning to experiment. In some families, for example, the parents may, as a matter of fact, encourage just this sort of thing.
Encourage the youngster to drink?
Yes. That is, they fully intend that the youngster himself will include drinking in his lifestyle and feel that it's much better to have some control on suggesting what that style ought to be, rather than simply letting him learn it on his own without their control and supervision.
Well, what do other kids do in regards to the effect on, say, a child? Do they come and say, look, try a shot, or would they say, here, try this beer? Do they recommend various drinks?
Well, here again, this varies tremendously. Part of the mythology about the drinking behavior of young people is that this is a kind of preoccupation of theirs. This doesn't happen to be the case. There are various times and there are various situations in which whether the young person is going to drink or not, and how he's going to drink, and with whom, and what he's going to drink. This may be an important topic, but it's not something that preoccupies him day in and day out. He's got other issues, which are important to him.
Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox, our topic, Why Do Teenagers Drink? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
I was driving along while this other guy comes up behind me and he starts riding my bumper. I have to make this turn, so I put on the brakes and he slams right into me. There's nothing I could do about it. You're trying to make a turn.
Nothing you could do about it? Nonsense. Maybe you can't stop careless or reckless drivers, but there's absolutely no reason why you can't watch out for them. You can defend yourself by staying out of their way. Yes, you can. Listen, when another driver tailgates your car, don't speed up. That just increases the danger. Slow down a little. Leave him plenty of time to pass you and go on his way. Now, that sounds simple, but believe me, it works. Now, some people call this sort of thing defensive driving. It's really just good common sense. After all, nearly half the drivers involved in fatal collisions are good drivers and in the right. But being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call. And here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox. And the professor is from Duke University. Our topic, why do teenagers drink? And if you'd like to comment on drinking teenagers or ask a question of the good professor, call us here at Night Call. You may dial us direct. If you wish, you may make it collect. The number to call is 313-846-6601. That's area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open. The operator is accepting calls. So give us a buzz here at Night Call. Area code 313-846-6601. Professor Maddox, what was the significance of this Darien, Connecticut affair?
We read a lot about this about a year ago.
Well, for those who may not know about the Darien, Connecticut affair, it had to do with parents who not only permitted their young people to drink, but provided the alcoholic beverages for them and were quite aware that they were drinking. There followed an event in which there was a traffic accident and a death in which one of the young persons involved in the driving had been drinking. The significance, I think, is that this is the sort of behavior that many parents involve themselves in every day. The Darien, Connecticut affair was only one of those instances in which there was a tragic event following, and it was an exceptional event. Many parents provide alcoholic beverages for older young people. They did it before the Darien affair, they have done it after, and will continue to do so. I think the kind of problem this poses is not only to remind us that alcohol is not just another beverage, but it's one that has some consequences about which young people ought to be aware, but it poses a real problem for the parents. It's one thing, for example, for them to feel that they know their own young person well enough to introduce them to alcohol and believe that they're helping the young person. It's quite another thing to involve somebody else's young person in your home with the use of an alcoholic beverage, a young person that you may not know nearly so well that you feel you know your own. I think there's an interesting moral issue, and it's certainly a very practical issue for parents who have one parental rule which applies to their family, but they aren't sure it applies when they're dealing with somebody else's children. I think this is what Darien means to me.
You're suggesting, then, that it might be all right for a parent to allow his youngster to drink, but it's very dangerous, indeed, to allow liquor to be served to other people's youngsters.
Well, dangerous, I think I'd like to come back to repeat why I think it raises a special problem. It's important that we assume that the parent knows something about his young person. And it's because he knows something about him that he might feel more or less free to introduce that young person to alcohol. If he knew as much about the other young people as he knew about his own, he would feel freer, I think, to make a decision about whether to offer other young people beverage alcohol or not. But if he doesn't know, I think this is exactly what poses the problem for him. And most of the time, we don't know other people's young people the way we think we know our own, and therefore the problem.
Professor, I have a caller now, a listener on KTLN from Denver, Colorado, Miss Eleanor Golden. Hello, Eleanor, speak right up. You're on Night Call, ma'am.
Okay, I was wanting to ask the professor, this is really the first time I have called you, but I did have to get my nose into this thing. I wanted to ask him about the statement that he made that, I mean, when parents drink, you know, children usually drink. I don't agree with this because I lived in a state that was west of this where the drinking was supposedly, I mean, against their religion. And yet these children would go up into the cabins and just drink themselves sick. And I would like to ask him why. It is, I mean, usually said that actually Jewish, you know, men and children don't get drunk as often as the others, according to statistics. I think it's because it is in the home and used at holiday dinners, and really wine is used when the children are very young. And having had two sons, my kids never would drink and drive. If they were going out New Year's Eve, they would not drink. And yet they could get it in the home if they wanted it. Would you ask him to comment about the fact that, I mean, why people of Jewish heritage are really very low, I mean, as far as percentages of being drunk, and also the fact that it is because I think it is in the home, it is there for them to take if they want it, and they don't usually want it.
Professor, is there anything to this idea that
yes,
Eleanor has?
I've heard the question. I think it's very much to the point. You're quite right that it's often said, and correctly, that Jewish people, while they have a high incidence of exposure to use, that is, you find many, most Jewish people who use beverage alcohol at some time, that there's very infrequently that we observe them having problems with alcohol use. And I think you're quite right in pointing out that it has something to do with the way in which alcohol is brought into the total life of the Jewish family. And that's the crucial point. It's how alcohol is fitted into the total scheme of life. And here, alcohol is not the center of what's going on. It is involved in a very integral way with living. So it's not the alcohol, it's the living that's the center of the Jewish focus. The alcohol is incidental. Now, you were referring to a state in which, to the west of you, where young people presumably are not exposed to drinking parents who nonetheless drink. I think this is a very pertinent observation, too, that when the young person has any occasion to express his hostility or rebellion toward adults, he has no understanding of alcohol in any other way except to use it to try to hurt himself or someone else in the process. This happens too. This would be unlikely among Jewish people because they have never come to view alcohol as something wrong, something they could use to hurt someone, including themselves as well as other people. If a young person grows up in a society where alcohol is defined as, by definition, bad, harmful, as capable of hurting someone, then he has a weapon which he can use against other people as well as himself. I think this is what you're referring to when you do find young people who do express their hostility. Now, when I was talking earlier about the young people who, by and large, don't have a problem with alcohol, I didn't mean that none of them do or that none of them express their hostility toward themselves or toward their parents. Some do. And I think you're quite right in seeing there are certain kinds of family situations in which alcohol is going to be used, if at all, in a very negative, harmful, hostile way. We do see that kind of thing. But that's a minority of the young people. The typical pattern is that when we know what the adult is doing with alcohol, that's our best single guess about how the young person is going to use it.
Eleanor, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
I appreciate it, but I think they ought to take really a book, in other words, really a leaf from that book, if it has worked. I mean, they should use it. If it were my teenager and he actually drank and he drove, I would take him to a hospital just to show him one accident. That's cured darn fast. And thank you so much.
Thank you for your comments. They've been most interesting. Eleanor Golden from Denver, Colorado, a lady who's listening on KTLN. And let's go now to Billings, Montana, a listener on KGHL. A young fellow who is 12 years old, Clay Christensen. Hello, Clay. Speak right up. You're on night call. Clay? Hello, Clay? Well, we've lost Clay here on the connection, Professor.
Too bad.
I'm sure he may call back. If Clay's listening, will you please redial the call? The lines are open, and I'll remind you that that number is area code 313-846-6601. Well, we'll go out to Torrington, Wyoming, a listener on KGOS, Mr. Hickson. Hello, Mr. Hickson. Speak right up, sir. You're on night call.
I'd like to make a comment first and then ask some questions.
Yes, sir.
I think one reason that the Jewish people have less alcoholism is because they use wine in the observance of their religion. In other words, the motivation makes quite a difference in the use of alcohol. And I'd like to ask the professor if how he feels the church should deal with this kind of a situation. What should be the attitude of the church?
Dr. Maddox?
Yes, I would quite agree. The comment about the way in which a Jewish person, an Orthodox Jew, is taught to think about alcohol. He does come at it. He does come at drinking with a very special orientation, in which the drinking in itself is incidental to something much more basic, which is his style of life, his belief, his relationships with other people. Now, when we ask about the church, I take it that one is now talking about the Protestant Catholic tradition.
Right.
Now, it's clear, I think, historically, that we can't talk about the church because the church has taken many different positions. One can find among Catholics, Episcopalians, Baptists, Methodists, some very different orientations about what specifically drinking ought to mean. But I think it's important that in the last 10 or 15 years, I have seen, I believe, some very important changes that have been going on in the churches. If we take the Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church or the Presbyterian Church and look at their literature of the last 10 years, I think one thing we see which is quite clear, and it's this. It was very popular a few years ago to take the position that there should simply be no drinking. This was not something to be argued or discussed. It was simply to be taken as a matter of course. The Christian did not drink. We found in the last 10 years that the Episcopalians have tried quite hard to take a somewhat different position from that. They tried to argue that if we understand natural theology, then we have a basis for asking ourselves the question, what is it that we're after when we're drinking? And does this really contribute to the achievement of the important values and goals in life? The Methodists are taking very much more the same kind of position. They are restating again and again that they believe that the abstinent way of life is the preferred way of life, but it's something to be talked about, that there is a real choice here, and that one needs to understand both the historic basis of his faith, he needs to understand something of the theological background of this issue, and then he can come more intelligently to answer for himself what he ought to be doing. I think there's been a much more reasonable approach, believing that abstinence is a preferred style of life, but then also believing that people have to come to this decision for themselves. This is the change I've seen, and it's certainly one which I would support. I think it's a much more hopeful position. And if anything is clear to me, it was that the abstinence position, with no argument, simply was not successful. I think the kinds of changes we've seen in some of the churches reflect their awareness that the old-style hellfire and damnation orientation to drinking simply could not be supported any longer for a very simple reason. It wasn't working.
Mr. Hickson, any other comments?
Well, it seems to me that drinking is more of a emotional problem than it is a intellectual problem. And I wondered what the professor would think of that. In other words, a person drinks because he wants to and not whether or not it's good for him or not.
Professor?
Yes, well, now, there is an emotional element here, but I wouldn't argue with you about it all. I don't believe that being rational is going to solve all of our problems. I am, however, a firm believer, I'm hopeful about education, that more and more it is possible to bring more and more aspects of our lives under rational control. And I don't believe that this is something we can be totally successful with. It's a hope I have that we can get people to be as rational as they are capable of being.
Mr. Hickson, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you,
sir, for your comments. A gentleman from Torrington, Wyoming, a listener on KGOS.
Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox. Our topic, Why Do Teenagers Drink? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Hello. I'm Shari Lewis, but today I'm not going to talk about Lamb Chop or Charlie Horse. I want to talk about real children, children who have arthritis. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? We always seem to think arthritis only attacks older people. But listen.
We never gave it a thought of arthritis, being that the child was so young. Because whoever figured a baby would come up with arthritis.
My cat says meow, my dog says bow wow. Oh listen, they're both talking now.
Well, there you have it. The reason why all of us must support medical research. Vital research that will someday bring a cure. And that's why I'm asking you to give. And give all you can to your arthritis foundation. For care today, for a cure tomorrow.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Our topic tonight, Why Do Teenagers Drink? Our guest, Professor George L. Maddox, who is co-author of a book called Drinking Among Teenagers, and also is a professor in the Medical Sociology Department of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Professor, I would invite our listeners to call you here if they have a question, and they can dial us here at Night Call by dialing 313-846-6601. Now, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number to call us at is area code 313-846-6601. The operators are now on duty, and the lines are open. Area code 313-846-6601. Professor Maddox, we have a caller from Denver, Colorado, standing by. A listener on KTLN, Ruby Terry. Hello, speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Dr. Maddox, I would like to ask you some questions of what causes drinking in college students. Is it more or less a status pressure by parents, or does it stem from pressures of student life itself, or would it be some conformity and identity with campus in-groups?
I would have to say that every one of the alternatives that you presented would in some sense be correct. Alcohol means many things to many people, and there are many reasons why people drink. And when we're talking about the young person in college, there are several points I think we need to make by way of background. This is an area about which we have some good research, and the indication is quite clear. The typical young person does not learn to drink in college. He's already had his exposure before he gets to college. Now, that's the typical young person. There are some who do not drink until after they're there. Most have already been exposed to the use of alcohol before they get there. But in a very important sense, in college, many of them do learn to drink in the sense that they develop a style of drinking about how much, where, with whom, what. So there is some learning that goes on in college. Now, if the typical young person who comes to college is in large part caricaturing the kind of drinking style he saw in his home, then this will account for much of what we see. But you are quite right in pointing out that in college, through the happenstance of the particular clique with which the young person identifies, we may see his drinking pushed in one direction or the other. We do find situations in which a young person, through happenstance, is involved with a clique of young people who drink out of boredom, for example, and may drink too much. One hears reports from specific colleges, for example, about weekend drinking behavior that seems to be a reflection as much as of the boredom of the particular situation of that college as it does anything else. So there are family background factors to be considered. There are the specific factors of the clique in which the young person happens to find himself. Both of these things may operate, and I think these are two of the most important factors to be dealt with in understanding the drinking behavior of college students.
Ruby?
Yes, sir?
Some further comments that you have?
Well, I think that the doctor has answered my questions fairly well.
Well, we want to thank you for calling Night Call. You're very kind. Ruby Terry from Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN. And let's go out to Billings, Montana now, to a listener on KGHL, Carolyn Story. Hello, Carolyn. Speak right up, ma'am. You're on Night Call.
Yes, I have a comment to make to the professor.
Okay.
I spent almost 2 years in France. I was stationed right outside of Paris, and wine is quite prevalent over there, and you never run into the alcohol problem with children in France, like
the
children in the United States.
I wonder why that is.
Well, they serve it with meals. In fact, they started with children
at
the age of two.
Two?
They water it down. They give them about a fourth of a glass of wine and fill the rest up with water. You've never seen any teenagers drinking over there. And I was wondering if the professor could comment on this, what he's doing anything about it.
Dr. Maddox, would you care to comment on that?
I'm not sure I heard all of the tales. I think I got the drift of the conversation about the drinking behavior of the French. One of the two common illustrations of the differences in the way in which people drink and the consequences these differences have are the French and the Italians. Even these two drink very differently. If we take a look at the French, their drinking behavior very frequently is unrelated to their eating, though there's a great deal of eating and drinking. In contrast to Italy, the French do a lot of drinking that is not related to eating. Now, there was a time when it was commonly said that the French do not have any drinking problems. More careful research in recent years indicates that's not quite correct. They have a different kind of drinking problem, and it's likely to appear in terms of physiological manifestations.
Now, what does that mean?
It means that if we look at how much the Frenchman drinks, we find a fair number of laboring people in France who may drink so much and so often that if we took a blood alcohol test of these people, they would be considered under the influence almost any day, all day, by American standards.
They're addicted to alcohol, then?
Well, in a physiological sense, they continue to operate. They hold a job, for example. They continue to appear in public as though they are under control. They have no peculiar psychological manifestations that we would associate with alcoholism in this country. And yet, in a physiological sense, they're doing great damage to themselves. We see a different kind of problem with drinking too much in France. And the caller is quite correct. We don't see the kinds of problems with drinking in France that we see here, which is not to say the French don't have problems. Now, it's true that the young person in France is presented to alcohol use in a very low-key manner. It's not the great issue as it very frequently is in this country, which is not to say, however, there are not problems with young people drinking in France. A few years ago, for example, it was possible for people who looked closely to turn up young people, that is, the age 10 to 12, who gave many of the signs, for example, of being physiologically addicted to alcohol. Now, these are rare cases. It can happen in France. It can happen as it can happen anywhere. But the caller is quite correct. The French handle their alcohol much better than most.
Carolyn, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Well, you thank you successfully. Thank you.
Thank you. Carolyn Story, a lady from Billings, Montana, listener on KGHL. Dr. Maddox, we've been jumping all around here, but we still, I don't think, have nailed down what should the parent actually do as far as teenage drinking is concerned. How would you handle it in your family? I don't know whether you have teenage children, but how would you approach it?
Well, I have a daughter who's just becoming a teenager. This is not something, for example, I think about which one can give hard and fast rules. I have parents ask me at various times, for example, in a question like this. They approach me and say, I have a teenage daughter, a son. What should I tell them? My first comment to them always is, you've already been telling them something for the last 12 or 13 years, not only about alcohol, but about living and how alcohol would fit into living or would not fit into it. We're talking about a process really of development in a general sense. In the state of Vermont, for example, they put on all their publications, which are designed to help parents and young people to understand drinking. They put this little phrase, with focus on youth. And I think this is where the focus ought to be. If we're talking about what to say to people about alcohol, I think we have the wrong emphasis. We ought to ask, what do we need to say to people about living? And then we raise the question, well, after we talk about what we're after in the process of living and what's important to us, then we can talk about how specific things like drinking or smoking or sex or something else, how that fits. But it's wrong, I think, to start asking, what do you say about alcohol, until you've asked the more basic questions of what are you going to say about life and living.
And what are we saying about our society by the way we approach alcohol in this country?
Well, I think by common consent, Americans drink as poorly as any people that we know anything about.
And what do you mean?
I mean, for example, we have more problems with drinking in this society. That is, we stand up among the very top of the list of the people who have difficulty with drinking. Our rate of alcoholism, for example, is extraordinarily high as we look at various peoples around the world. And our attitudes, I think, are clearly related to this.
Is it because we are emotionally immature? Is this what you're saying?
Well, no, I think that's a little too large and simple a judgment about the situation. I would say, however, that the American does typically express a kind of ambivalence, a kind of wanting and not wanting, a confusion about alcohol that is profound and is reflected in our history. Historically, we have been considered by outsiders looking at us as a hard-drinking people. And that's correct. We do drink a lot of hard liquor. At the same time, we are one of the few, if not the only nation, that has mounted a prohibitionist movement to the extent that we did. And we are hard-drinking prohibitionist people.
Sort of schizophrenic, then.
That's a loaded word, but if we mean by that a basic kind of confusion about how we feel about drinking, I think that's quite correct. If you take a look at the fact that most adults in this society use alcohol at some time, and then look at our legislation, which requires that we teach young people about the evils of drinking, you begin to get some sense that something strange is going on. Or when you find adults who themselves drink, who do a great deal of agonizing about, should we permit our young people to see us drinking, this is reflecting the same kind of ambivalence which pervades this society. This year, for example, there are two books, I think, that every American ought to look at side by side. Because in a way they tell us something about Americans and drinking. One is by J.C. Furnas, entitled The Life and Times of Demon Rum. This is a study of the history of prohibition in this country, chapter and verse. Side by side is a book by Morris Chaffetz, Massachusetts General Hospital, entitled Liquor, the Servant of Man. Now, you couldn't get two more diverse views of what alcohol means and has meant in American life than to lay these books side by side and see what they say. But that almost captures the essence of a peculiarly American orientation to drinking. And it's a very ambivalent one. And it creates real problems for adults trying to say something to their young people in that kind of environment.
Your book, Drinking Among Teenagers, is this basically a case study or is this advice to parents?
Well, it's primarily a study of the drinking behavior of the high school students of a Midwestern town. It's largely their story. Was intended, for example, to talk with these young people and let them convey the answer to such questions of what are we doing with alcohol, what do we think about it, what does it mean to us? And it's really a teenager's story of what alcohol means to him.
Are teenagers pretty honest about telling adults their drinking habits or what they really think?
Well, it depends, I think, on the kind of relationship you establish with them. In my experience, I've found that it's possible if you aren't too pushy with young people and I'm not sure what it is that conveys to them that you're a right guy, but my feeling is that if you let people know that you're really interested in listening, you let the young people know you're interested in what they have to say, they will level with you. And I found all around the country that young people seem very willing to talk and to level with me and others that I know about this issue.
Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox. Our topic, Why Do Teenagers Drink? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Well, you see, here's what happened. I was just starting to pass the car ahead of me, and then he suddenly swung out and tried to pass the car ahead of him. I guess he never saw me. And that's when it happened.
Famous last words. I guess he never saw me. Now, the point is, as long as you saw him, accidents like that don't have to happen. Remember, safety first begins between the ears. Now, maybe you can't expect everybody to drive as well as you, but you can at least watch out for those who don't. You can watch out for their mistakes and sudden moves, like professional drivers do. For example, before passing another car on the highway, flash your lights or sound your horn. Let them know you're coming. Don't rely on other drivers to see you and keep out of your way. So protect yourself by driving defensively. Remember, nearly half the drivers in fatal accidents are in the right. So just being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox, who is co-author of a book called Drinking Among Teenagers, and our topic, Why Do Teenagers Drink? If you'd like to join us here, our lines are now open at Night Call. Give us a call at area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may dial us direct, and if you wish, you may make the call collect. Our number, area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open. Let's hear your comment about drinking teenagers. Dr. Maddox, what about this idea that we've been reading about in the paper of near beer? First of all, what is near beer, and is this a good way to introduce teenagers to drinking?
Well, the near beer that you've been hearing about is really a very old idea. It's a malt product in which the alcohol content is extremely low when you have only an infinitesimal amount of alcohol. This is why it's called near beer. It's a beer-like product with no alcohol in it. It was very common during Prohibition days when theoretically one could not produce a beverage alcohol. It's been reintroduced. It's been around. For example, in the Midwest, in my student days there, it was possible to buy near beer in the local grocery. Recently, in the Chicago area, there's been a company that has reintroduced this and has giving it some promotion. It's being presented as a way in which young people can be kept from drinking by letting them have all the symbolic aspects of drinking. That is, the bottle, it looks like a beer bottle, the smell, the taste, but without the alcohol. I have serious doubts about whether it keeps young people from drinking. We don't know this, as a matter of fact. There's not been any research done on it. But the people who are pushing near beer are saying, for example, it offers an alternative. Personally, I doubt this.
Do you think that the use of near beer could encourage a kid to go on to bigger and better drinks, as it were, such as the real stuff?
Well, I doubt that near beer really makes that much difference one way or the other. I doubt if it entices anybody to drink who doesn't have some motivation to do so. So anyway, it might make the transition a little easier for the young person who comes out of an abstinent background, who finds drinking the real thing a little bit too much for him. Maybe the transition of near beer would help him to make the transition more easily. This I don't know. That's a possibility.
Professor, we have a caller from New York, a listener on WBAL, Mr. Melzig. Hello, sir. Speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Professor Maddox, I'd like to ask you why throughout this conversation, and as a matter of fact, you hear people talk and write about teenagers drinking, and everything you seem to hear seems to assume that there's something wrong, i.e., you talk about the use of alcohol. Well, I'm 22, I'm a graduate student, and in my college and high school days, kids got together, drank, gave parties, and admittedly, every now and then, someone drank too much and got sick. But especially where there is no automobile involved, why is this so long? Why is this such a necessity
and problem? I didn't hear all of that, but I think maybe the last part of the last question that you raised there is the heart of what you wanted to know. I haven't been meaning to imply all along that I believe that this is wrong. I think all I've been trying to convey is that there are specific people in our society who do talk about the use of alcohol by teenagers as though it's wrong. There are large concentrations of people in certain religious organizations who take the position that drinking in general is wrong, and therefore drinking among teenagers is wrong. There are law enforcement officials, for example, who point out that in the typical state, it's illegal for the young person to purchase and or consume beverage alcohol, at least publicly. So we are talking about a society that has passed judgment in terms of its laws. Now, whether those laws should be as they are is something that's being debated. If you are calling from the New York area, you are very much aware that New York, in contrast to New Jersey and Connecticut, has fought this battle publicly for a long time.
How old do you have to be to drink in New York?
18.
18. Okay.
Now, I think the recent session of the legislature in New York did everybody a service. And they're coming at this issue about, is an 18-year-old person old enough to drink? They had been subjected to pressure by New Jersey and Connecticut to raise the drinking age to 21. And a New York committee in the legislature looked at this issue and said, no, we do not want to change our law, because there is no indication that between 18 and 21 that there is any significant change in the drinking behavior of young people, and they are factually correct. And then they went on to say that we believe that the change of the law would only tend to drive the young person to drink in places that are less desirable than the places where he's now drinking. We feel that New Jersey and Connecticut should change their law rather than asking us to change ours. I think what we're illustrating here in this question about why do so many people think that drinking is wrong goes back to what we were talking about earlier, Russ. That we have a strange history in which prohibition has been an important part of this history, and there are many vestiges of this still around. And I think this question is simply pointing this out to us.
Professor, would you be for lowering the drinking age to 18 in all our states?
Well, I don't like to put myself in a position of making such a recommendation in a blanket way. I would only say I think that there's a lot of merit in the position that New York State has taken with regard to 18. Everything I know about what happens to young people in the process of growing up indicates that by 18, most of them have graduated from high school, they have moved well toward marriage, toward a full-time job, toward participation in the armed forces. For all practical purposes, they have assumed adult-like roles. It's unrealistic, it seems to me, to insist that somehow between 18 and 21, we're going to continue to treat them as though they are not adults. Their drinking behavior, for example, is essentially established at 18. And holding the law at 21 only ensures that there are going to be devious ways in which the young person is going to drink. The laws have very little to do with the observed drinking behavior of the young people, as a matter of fact.
Professor, you're basing this on factual information that you have.
That's right.
And not opinion.
A matter of opinion. This is a matter of fact.
Mr. Melfzig, did you have any other comments you'd like to make?
One more question.
Yes, sir.
Where does the use of alcohol rather than drinking?
This is not a distinction, I think, on which anything of importance hangs. I've gotten in the habit of talking about alcohol use largely because, in my experience in talking with young people, to talk about taking a drink for many people is a very alerting kind of thing to ask them. I found, for example, if you ask a young person if he drinks, he is very likely to tell you no, because drinking to him means drinking too much. The word drinking, I think one can get a real insight into the peculiarities of American drinking behavior by just asking a random collection of people what it means to drink or what it means to be a drinker. I use of alcohol because I think it's, I found in my experience, it's a more neutral kind of term.
Well, thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Mr. Melzig, a gentleman from Albany, New York, a listener on WBAL. Professor, what about Indians? I read once where the alcoholic problem that they have is because some of the tribes believe that getting drunk allows them to have visions, which in turn allows them to communicate with God. Have you ever heard this?
Well, not so much about alcohol as such things like peyote. Alcohol might very well serve that same kind of purpose. I think that the history of alcohol use among the Indians is better understood, however, as a way of expressing aggression toward the white man who, among other things, denied them access to alcohol in a very punitive way. So that the response of many Indians was to, in a sense, pay the white man back by using alcohol almost as a weapon against the white man, and incidentally, he got caught up in using it as a weapon against himself.
That's basically what some teenagers are doing then with alcohol.
No question. And just as we might say the same thing about an automobile. An automobile is a destructive weapon in the hand of some people, including teenagers. So is alcohol.
Do you think it's wise for a teenager to learn early in his career his capacity for alcohol?
Yes. This raises, I think, a very important issue about an orientation to drinking. I've been very much impressed to the last few years, as a matter of fact, with the position taken by the Ontario program in Canada. They have chosen not to argue about whether people should drink or not, realizing that's a very complex issue that ought to be handled more at the local level, in the family, for example, or in the church group. They have taken the position, however, that whether you drink or not is not so much the issue, but if you drink, there are some things it's best to know. And I very much support this point of view. I was talking recently to a young lady in Ohio who said, do you believe that your first drink is, your first drink on the way to alcoholism? And I said, well, what do you think? Well, she said, I was told it's by a very reputable person. I said, you're evading me. What do you think? She said, well, he ought to know. I said, what do you think? She says, no, I don't believe it. Then this led to a conversation about what do you know about alcohol? And I found her to be a fairly naive person. If one is going to drink, I would say it's extremely important that he knows something about what alcohol is as a beverage, what it is capable of doing, not only for the individual, but to him. There are some things it's best to know.
This is the Ontario program that you're talking about, Ontario, Canada.
Yes.
Would you say that they're ahead of the United States as far as their treatment of the problem of teenage drinking?
Well, I think their whole program, both in terms of services offered to the alcoholic, their educational program, specific aspects of it may be no better than what we find in specific states in this country, but as an overall program of research and education and service, I would say the Ontario program certainly will compete favorably with anything we have in this country, and I personally believe it's a little better.
Our guest tonight, Professor George L. Maddox. Professor, I want to thank you for being our guest. We've enjoyed your comments.
Pleasure to be talking with you and these fine people around the country.
And I want to remind our listeners that they can get your book called Drinking Among Teenagers in most any library. And, Doctor, that's published by what company?
It's published by the Rutgers Center of Alcohol Studies in New Brunswick, Connecticut. New Brunswick, New Jersey, I beg your pardon.
Okay. Thank you again, Professor George L. Maddox. Our topic tonight, do teenagers drink? Monday night on Night Call, Emily Kingsbury, professional writer, begins a full week Night Call series on crime. So you'll want to be with us next week. Until Monday, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station as a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.